Hello, and welcome to Volume 91 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll hear about the U.S. response to this being declared by the United Nations as the International Year of the Forest. We'll learn about the latest changes in the estate tax laws. We'll learn about what trees to plant for deer hunting. And we'll hear about a decision by Georgia-Pacific to make some pine plantations off-limits to their procurement foresters. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Well, July 1st, 2008 is potentially an important date for Georgia-Pacific customers. If you converted a natural hardwood stand to a pine plantation, after that date, Georgia-Pacific has committed itself not to purchase the pine from that stand. That's one of the provisions of the Georgia-Pacific Statement on Forest Protection and Sustainability, and we're pleased to have Georgia-Pacific's VP for Sustainability, Deborah Baker, to talk about this new policy. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Hayes. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all.
Well, tell us why Georgia-Pacific developed this policy called the Statement on Forest Protection and Sustainable Practices.
Yes, well, this gave us an opportunity at Georgia-Pacific to address issues that have been of increasing interest to our customers and actually to our consumers. So what we wanted to do was reaffirm the many things that we already do, such as the third-party certification of our wood and fiber supply system, our requirement to have suppliers be trained in sustainable practices, and then, you know, to look at things such as requiring the use of voluntary and mandatory best management practices. So what we did was go one more step further and looked at how we could address these other issues we hear about, endangered forests, natural hardwood forests, and conversion. So this was an opportunity for GP to address concerns we were hearing.
Well, what is GP doing specifically different from what other companies are doing in the hardwood area?
Well, this is the first time that a forest products company has really taken a scientific approach to identifying and mapping these endangered forests and then also what is a natural hardwood site. So it's really taken the science, putting a set methodology, getting some agreement from academia and some of the environmental groups on what is that science, and then that will enable GP to help protect those rare and unique lands.
So first you have to determine what areas you're talking about, and that's done through some sort of mapping data?
Yes, and it takes in particular scientific data in order to put the maps together. So you end up doing a layering of maps. So you've looked at certain scientific research that's already been completed, and then you map it. And then it's very on the ground as well. We're going back in and looking on the ground. So it's taking the science, putting it on a map, and then checking it as well on the ground. That has not been done to this point in time. To this degree, at this scale for a company like Georgia-Pacific.
Is that part of the way that GP is implementing these commitments to identify and map these areas?
Well, our implementation process obviously involves the actual mapping and completing that work. We've only done it in one area on endangered forests in the mid-Atlantic, so we have to continue that process around the other fiber sourcing basins that we have. And then we have other additional implementation procedures that we're developing within the company in how we would meet that obligation.
Did we say it correctly that after July 1, 2008, if a landowner has converted or is going to convert his natural hardwood forest to a pine plantation, Georgia-Pacific would not wish to purchase that wood?
That is what the statement says, and it's important to know that it's Georgia-Pacific working on a scientific definition for what is a natural hardwood site. So we're not looking at a natural pine stand. Think about the mixed stands that you have, for instance, in Alabama. That's not what we're considering as a natural hardwood. So we're not opposed to people planting trees. We know that's a very important part of silvicultural and forestry. What we're looking at is is those that are we're helping to define as a natural hardwood, we don't want to have those converted. And in most cases, you know, that takes a lot. So there is a lot more effort anytime you're taking planting. And if you're trying to convert a hardwood site, a natural hardwood site to a pine, you're probably going to be spending a lot of time and effort. So we're trying to really narrow what is the scope of that. And so GP is looking at really areas that should be natural hardwoods. We would like to see them stay as natural hardwoods.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, Deborah. We appreciate that. Well, this is the United Nations International Year of the Forest, and we thought this was a golden opportunity to tell our story on a world stage, one that's likely to be completely different from, say, Canada's story or Germany's story or South America's story. So we're pleased to learn that Thomas Martin will be assisting in the U.S. response. Welcome, Mr. Martin.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Hayes.
What would you say is important for an international audience to know about what's unique about America's forest?
I think there are a couple of things that are unique. First, most of the forests in the United States are not owned by the government. They're owned by private folks. The biggest chunk of our forest is owned by family woodland owners. That's just not the case in the rest of the world. If we're going to conserve forests here in the U.S., it's got to be voluntary private action that makes that happen. The good news is most woodland owners want to do right by their land. And so if you talk to folks throughout Alabama, in fact, our tree farmer of the year nationally came from Alabama this year, there's a deep sense of pride in making sure that their land is there for future generations. If you ask somebody about their land in Alabama, you're likely to get a story about their family and what this land means, what meant to their parents or grandparents, and what they hope it's going to mean to their kids.
Mm-hmm. Private ownership is something that would possibly surprise people in other countries. What are some of the specific challenges that private landowners face in the U.S.?
You know, I think of there's three big buckets of challenges. One is kind of the environment that the forests exist in, the physical environment. And down in Alabama, of course, the southern pine beetle is one of those things. I was out on one of our tree farmers' land in southern Alabama not long ago, and we were looking at the devastation that Hurricane Ivan did. So first, managing for the long term, a generation or two generations before you actually cut your trees,
mm-hmm.
Means making a bet that you can guess what's going to happen in the environment around you. The second thing is the cost of management. It, frankly, good management takes some money. It takes the ability to be able to come in, remove exotic species, do the right kind of thinning so that you can get the kind of value you want from your land, whether it's timber value or whether it's just good hunting land. And so things like taxes, which you're going to talk about in a little bit, have an enormous impact on your ability to do that. And the final thing is income from the land. And in Alabama, for a typical woodland owner, that's a mix of hunting leases and thoughtful, sustainable harvesting of your property. Unfortunately, the harvesting needs to have decent markets. And at the moment, I think everybody knows that our wood markets are in the tank, hopefully coming up. But, again, good management takes good markets, takes some income and some investment.
Just a word about the American Tree Farm System, which you're associated with.
Yeah, the American Tree Farm System is the largest and oldest sustainable forestry program in the country. We've got 96,000 members, 26 million acres. And all of these folks are showing that they're doing right by their land by putting together a management plan that meets international requirements. And that gives them access to some markets. But the other thing it does is it gives them access to cost share dollars. So these folks, by adopting that kind of management plan, are putting in place that kind of long-term strategy that allows you to plant a tree today, thinking about what your grandkids going to take from it a couple of generations down the road. So the tree farm system is run by 5,000 volunteers. There's a state tree farm committee in Alabama. We work very closely with the Alabama Forestry Commission. Linda Casey does a terrific job, and also the Alabama Forestry Association and Chris Isaacson and company are great partners as well.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Barr. We appreciate that. Well, last month there were major changes in the estate tax law, so we wanted to check in with Henry Barclay to help keep us current on these changes. Hello, Henry.
Hey there, Hayes.
How have the estate tax laws changed?
Well, Hayes, December 17th, the president signed a new estate and gift tax, both law. We were expecting that. But what's not widely publicized is that that law is effective for decedents dying after December 31st, 2009, mm-hmm. and for gifts made after December 31st, 2010. The new estate tax law has the same stepped-up basis rules that we were used to back in 2009, which means that your tax basis for beneficiaries is determined based on the fair market value at the date of death of the decedent, generally.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In the 2010 had a no estate tax law, I call it, that had complicated basis step-up rules and limited the value that property could really be stepped up, created some income tax consequences, but it had something going for it. There was no estate tax. Mm-hmm. Under the new law, an executor may elect to have either the no estate tax law apply for 2010, if you had a 2010 decedent, mm-hmm. or the new law will apply. So one of the primary issues that has to be considered is the effect of this stepped-up basis versus the tax you might have to pay, and it's just a trade-off in money. So you really need to have your attorney or accountant evaluate where you are.
If you do have to pay the tax, what's the rate?
Well, the new rate is 35%, which is a reduction from the 45% that we were used to in 2009. So that's on estates over $5 million. So we were talking back and forth about whether we were going to have a $3.5 million exemption or a $4 million or what it was going to be. We've got a $5 million estate lifetime exemption in this new law, and the exemption is portable between spouses, which is a new feature. So if one spouse doesn't use the exemption, it's available to the other spouse after death, unless they remarry, and then some other rules kick in. This means that a married couple could actually leave a combined fair market value of $10 million before any tax would be paid, and that's good news.
Were there any changes in the gift tax laws?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question, because we had a disconnect between the gift tax laws and the estate tax laws as far as the amount of property that you could pass during life. Now they're linked together, and the exclusion mirrors the estate tax exclusion. So actually an individual may leave up to $5 million in lifetime gifts before they pay any gift tax, and that gift tax will be at 35%, which is exactly the same rate as the estate tax. So this is a very significant change, and it's good news to hear that the generation skipping tax also mirrors that change. So there's a $5 million exemption on the generation skipping side.
Okay.
The important issue, I think, that all of our timber owners need to get out of this is that they need to have their estate and gift plans reviewed. We may have some inflation in the future. It may drive values up, so they just need to have those reviewed. The caveat is the changes are for 2 years. So they expire in 2012. So the Congress will have to take a new look at this after 2012. So this is a law, and it's a favorable change, but it's on a short string.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Henry. Appreciate you clarifying that for us.
You bet.
Well, the last couple of years have been difficult ones for real estate investors, which means that it's even more important to correctly price your property and make those curb appeal improvements to help you stand out in the crowd. Robert King is a land agent with Alla Land Co., and he has some tips for potential sellers of land. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you for having me, Hay.
You said that pricing is the most important aspect of marketing. If I'm selling land, should I base my price on what I see other properties being priced in the area?
Well, no, it takes a little more expertise than that to get it priced correctly. The short answer to that is to base it off of recent comps in the area, but that may be difficult to find.
Recent comps, what does that mean?
Properties that have sold recently in the area, the price that they have sold for.
Mm-hmm.
The market today is very tied to the residential real estate market, but it's kind of a world away as well. The overall trends have a profound effect on the land prices, and but those markets are very, very local and very nuanced. Those nuances can be pretty difficult to quantify even for appraisers. The buyer today is not real forgiving, though. If they perceive that a property is overpriced, they just move on without looking further. They've got plenty to choose from. They want to spend their time looking at good deals, not negotiating with a seller that's overpriced.
Once you have your property priced correctly, what's the next thing to do to make your property stand out?
You want to make sure they have a good view of what you have for sale. People don't buy land on a whim. They generally examine it pretty thoroughly. The easier you can make that process for them, the more they will like the property. You want to mow your roads and fields. If you can't get to a part of your piece of property, you know, consider getting a good trail system throughout it. And also think about that curb appeal. Whatever you see when you first see that piece of property is generally the view that you will take home of that property.
Any other aspects that you would advise sellers and their agents to abide by?
You want to be honest with your agent. Let them know what your financial goals and conditions are. They're most likely representing your best interest, and they've got a responsibility to help you with those to the best of their ability. They can't do that without a good knowledge of your situation. So just be honest with them, and they can help you better that way.
All right. Well, thank you, Robert.
Appreciate that.
Our next guest, David Osborne, is the Deer Research Coordinator at the University of Georgia. And since we're still enjoying deer season in Alabama, we wanted to get his thoughts on planting fruit trees in your favorite hunting spot. Hello, David.
Hello, Hayes. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
How might a landowner benefit from planting fruit trees and also nut trees in their deer hunting spot?
Hayes, there's many ways that a landowner can benefit. Probably the main reason that most forest landowners plant fruit and nut tree orchards is to attract deer for hunting. You know, everyone knows that deer like to eat blackberries and nuts like acorns and you know, various fruits, and that they're attractive to deer and they provide important nutrition. The problem with these naturally growing fruits and nuts is that the landowner doesn't always have control over where they're located and when they drop their fruit. By planting a tree orchard, a landowner can place those orchards on the property where they're needed, and also by selecting different tree species and cultivars within a species, they can determine when the fruit drops.
All right. If you're already planting, say, a food plot with leafy green vegetation, why do I need to go to the trouble of augmenting that with these fruit and nut trees?
We think that the food plots are very important if you're intensively managed deer herds, but they're not. They're just one piece of the puzzle. You know, the deer need good quality year-round nutrition, and a lot of people think that high-protein food plots and high-protein deer pellets are the most important way you can supplement deer diets. But in reality, it's not dietary protein that's most limited; it's dietary energy. And by planting these fruit orchards, you can provide energy during a time of the year when energy can be limited because of the maturity of the green forage. Or, you know, and one reason too is, like in small food plots, deer may completely overgraze that plot and make it not very efficient anymore. Well, you can plant tree orchards in a relatively small place, and the productivity of that orchard is not limited by having too many deer as it would be with food plots. A lot of other reasons too, though, from an economic standpoint. Compared to food plots, tree orchards are more permanent over time, and all the initial cost is up front, well, at least most of it up front, unlike food plots where you have to reinvest time and energy and money year after year. Tree orchards, once you get them established and they become productive, require relatively little input.
All right. Well, thank you for those tips. Those are some good tips for the deer hunters out there. Appreciate it, David.
Very, very welcome.
Well, if growing hardwood trees is part of your plans, then you'll want to listen to our next guest, Dr. Jeff Stringer, who has some ideas on improving your chances at having a high-quality hardwood stand. Welcome, Dr. Stringer.
Good to be here.
A lot of tree farmers are familiar with site prep for planting pine, but is there also site prep treatments that are needed for hardwoods?
Yes, and oftentimes with planting pine, we're thinking about preparing the site, removing the debris that's there, that kind of thing, preparing for the mechanical planting. The hardwoods, we're relying upon natural regeneration of the species, the seed that's in the ground, the species that are there, and that kind of thing. So there are site preparation treatments that can be done at the time of harvest that will allow us to enhance the species composition and the quality of the trees that are going to start in that and through that natural regeneration. And, of course, starting with that platform gives us ability to then manage out into the future.
Well, so now you've got us thinking about site prep for hardwood trees, and when we normally think about site prep, we're thinking about the time right after a harvest. Are there situations where these site prep treatments need to occur several years before a harvest?
Yeah, and that's a good point, and that's certainly the case, because when you think about it, we're going to do a harvest, we're going to start regeneration. So the regeneration that's going to occur at that time is based on the seedlings that are present at that time, the seed that's in the ground, that kind of thing. And in some cases, specifically with the oaks, you need to think about developing those seedlings on the ground prior to when that harvest is done. That means we have to start thinking about regeneration before the harvest cut. And the time to do that may be up to 5 or 10 years before a harvest in some cases. And there's practices we can put in place that will help encourage the development of young oak seedlings. So when the harvest is done, we can count on those to produce the next trees in the next rotation.
Well, if you have to make decisions, based on limited time or funds, what type treatments do you do that will yield the most benefit?
Well, the treatments that yield the most benefit are in the cases where we've got a difference in the commercial species value in a stand. And I'll give you an example. You can have a high value oak in the stand, species in the stand, and you can have sweet gum. Okay? So if you can find those stands that have that species differential in them, some really high-valued species in there and some low-valued species, those are the stands that you want to work in, because the site preparation treatment can put you in the position of encouraging growth and the development of those high-quality species, limiting the growing space of the low-value species. So having that price differential in there, or that value differential between species, that's going to dictate where you put your money.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. String. We appreciate that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, some land not only has trees growing on the surface, but other valuable resources under the surface. If this involves removing coal by surface mining, then you should be aware of what say-so you have as the owner of the surface. Charlie Haynes can help us understand this. Hello, Charlie.
Hello.
Can the owner of a land, the surface, really exert any control over mining reclamation processes?
Well, he can stop the mining, for one thing, unless they get in a situation where the mineral rights owner has a reasonable right to access to the minerals, and that, again, depends on the situation. So if you're surface only, you can, of course, get damages, usually almost the same as the mineral owner will get. And just to give an example, if you're looking at maybe a 12% total royalty off the property, the mineral owner may get 7% and the surface 5%, for example. So almost parity, but the important thing is if you see this going down and you can't do very much about whether it's mad or not, you can at least make a better situation out of a potentially bad one. And you've also got to be the mindset that you don't get that emotionally involved with your land, contrary to what, you know, has been said before, and I can certainly understand that emotional attachment. You'll certainly have to take a vacation from growing trees for a while. But if it's properly reclaimed, you can see surprisingly good results down the line. And that, I guess that's the gist of my comments today, that just make a better situation out of what might be a bad one.
Okay. Well, how much and what is the best timing for an owner to intervene in such matters?
Well, very early. And I want to tell everybody in Alabama that we have a very good surface mining reclamation group in Jasper, Alabama. These people can be a service to you very early. I would say that if you see some impending mining, that you need to get in touch with these people and discuss your situation. Now, bear in mind that there'll be state regulations that will govern what can and can't be done as far as reclamation is concerned. But at the same time, you can work within those guidelines to for your purposes to make it the best it can be.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Charlie. We appreciate that. I don't know how you're doing with your New Year's resolutions, but one of mine was to be more intentional with things, to be move with purpose and to plan better. Jennifer Gagnon is someone who can help you get motivated to do these things with your forestry plan. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
What do you see as what is a family forest plan, and why is it important?
Well, one of the main threats to conserving private forests is a lack of communication within families. Many children inherit land, but they don't have any involvement with it. They don't have any emotional attachment to it. So we see this oftentimes leading to liquidation of the property or, at the very least, the disruption of plan management activities. So the idea behind family forest management planning is to get all the stakeholders involved in decision-making early on. So some of the benefits that a family will get from including their family members in their management decisions include things like making ownership dreams and values and goals known and understood, giving younger generations a sense of ownership and a say in how the land is managed, providing hopefully a sense of emotional attachment to the land, and ensuring management activities are carried out.
Usually the hardest thing to do is just to get started. What are your recommendations for a family just to get started in this process?
You know, it can be pretty informal to begin with. Parents can simply invite their children over to walk the forest land with them and talk about why it's important. They can share some of their management skills with their children, and I think most importantly, they can invite them to participate in the management process. So if the younger generation is open to this and they're interested in participating in management, they can call a family meeting. And if you do have a family meeting, it's important to invite everyone who has a stake in the land.
Now, what should they discuss when everybody gets there?
Well, family meeting can be used, the initial one can be used to discuss management goals. So a goal is a group or individual's vision for the future. It's really the big picture. And goals explain how we want something to be in the future. So a goal for your forest management might be to have a healthy and vigorous forest. And once you come to this list of goals, then future meetings can be set to help develop objectives. And those objectives are specific courses of action to attain your goals. And at some point, you might want to invite a professional forester to help you proceed with this. They can help you develop your objectives and tell you what's reasonable and what's not.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. I would say family members, family meetings can be used as an opportunity to identify conflicts of interest or to identify heirs that have a particular interest in managing the property. And these really help open the gateway to family communications. You know, engaging future owners in management decisions can help them develop a sense of ownership and a desire to keep the land within the family.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jennifer. We appreciate those tips. Very good. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Deborah Baker, Thomas Martin, Henry Barclay, and Robert King. We also appreciate the contributions of David Osborne, Jeffrey Stringer, Charlie Haynes, and Jennifer Gagnon. As Thomas Martin mentioned, 2011 has been declared by the United Nations General Assembly as the International Year of the Forest. How we practice forestry is different from how forestry is practiced in other countries, and it's not a difference in climate. It's largely because of our socio-legal heritage of privately owned property. That's easy to take for granted, but it's one of the things that makes the United States the most free, the most individualistic, the most democratic, open, and dynamic country in the world. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.